who are unable to attend today's session to view the proceedings at a later date. The recorded session will be made available on the Research Center website. And now, who's going to introduce Virginia? Bob. I'll turn it over to Bob.
Thanks, Kathy. We're really pleased to have Virginia back speaking to AU. For those that aren't aware, Virginia is an assistant professor with the Center for Nursing and Health Studies at Athabasca University. Employed since 1995, she served as term as chair of the Research Ethics Committee in 2001 as well. She's provided to both telephone, online, and face-to-face instruction for students in courses related to nursing research, guided independent study, trends and issues in nursing, physical assessment, family nursing, and home health nursing. She was the initial program development coordinator for Athabasca's University Advanced Graduate Diploma Community Nursing Practice, which is now the Master's in Nursing Program. Virginia's dissertation from the Faculty of Nursing at U of A is entitled Lightening the Load, a Grounded Theory of Nursing Support with Critical Care Family Members. Her MN work in nursing support has been published as a chapter in Supporting Critical Families, a Model to Guide Nursing Practice, in a text edited by Young and Hayes entitled Transforming Health Promotion Practice, Concepts, Issues, and Applications. She is also currently engaged in an AU, I won't say ARF, but the Athabasca Research Fund study with Catherine Moore, U of A, to investigate information needs of men and their spouses about prostate surgery. Virginia has worked as a nurse for over 35 years across a broad spectrum of health service delivery, education, and research occupations and in many Canadian geographical locations. Prior to employment at Athabasca University, she spearheaded the delivery of the first pre-licensure rural practical nursing program in Alberta and the opening of a community daycare both in Girard, Alberta, and was also a director of nursing of 175-bed rural health hospital. Was nurse practitioner in charge and for northern Aboriginal communities and practice as an emergency and critical care nurse in Edmonton and Calgary. Boy, that's making me tired. Virginia is a proud wife of David Walker, computer consultant and educator, and adoptive mother of three young adults and a grandmother to 2.5-year-old Christopher, and I'm sure we'll hear about in this, since most grandmothers can't not talk about their grandchildren. Anyways, without further ado, I give you Virginia Walker.
Thank you very much, Bob. I didn't know how long they wanted that bio, and I said, cut it, but you didn't. So anyway, it gives me great pleasure to be here today, obviously, because I'm going to be presenting my research that I spent so many years working with. Basically, the title of my topic today is Critical Illness, Family, and Nurses, Connecting the Dots. And the dots that I'm going to be connecting for you today are the family member, the critical care nurse, the critically ill patients, as well as a number of other ones that I haven't identified in this slide. The other title for my presentation is Lightening the Load, a Grounded Theory of Nursing Support with Family Members of Critically Ill Adults. That's the more academic term. I want to take this time to acknowledge Dr. Louise Jensen, my supervisor, as well as Dr. Kathleen Oberle, my co-supervisor. Collectively, their professional support has been the wind beneath my wings. And I hope you enjoy my presentation. I look forward to feedback from you. In terms of an overview, I will be discussing background information, the purpose, research question, design, and method, findings, which are the theory of lightening our load. This theory is comprised of the context of the environment, which includes the nurses, ICU, hospital, the patient, family and the family's work, as well as the process of nursing support. I'm going to discuss the relationship among related concepts, the limitations to this study, implications for nursing knowledge and practice, and future research. In terms of background information, for the family, everyone knows this, that the critical illness of a relative often constitutes a crisis. It interrupts or distorts their previous way of being, and it results in loss of control over the day-to-day management of their lives. They've been left feeling unbalanced and vulnerable. Needless to say, the experience is emotionally distressing. Many family members experience varying degrees of helplessness and hopelessness. As a result, a family member's experience may suppress the family member's immune system, be so stressful that he or she is unable to provide emotional support to the ill relative, result in depression, and even lead to post-traumatic stress disorder. And more research is being done in this area over the last 4 years, indicating that this is a very real threat of individuals having to deal with critical illness of a family member. There's lots of views about the family and critical illness. Some ICU nurses see family as annoying. They're unprepared to deal with the needs that the families present when they arrive. They're there focusing on the patient, and the family divert them from that focus, and they don't always appreciate it. There is the view that family and patient are interdependent, and therefore, how can you look after one without looking after the other? There's the view that family are important to patient recovery, and even research that has demonstrated how valuable they can be for reducing length of stay and improving the patient's overall quality of life while in ICU. Family have been written up as the voice of the patient, and if the voice of the patient, they are who the critical care nurse first speaks with when they admit a patient. Some have talked of the family unit as the patient, that we should never just look at the patient themselves as the patient. It's the whole unit that needs to be looked at as needing intervention. And recently, Molter, and I have that name in parentheses after this comment, she was the first originator of much of the research looking at critical care families back in the late 70s. Her big push now is that families are not visitors. Visitors are other people. Family should be there. They should be partners. And Huxley is one of the new names on the block who's been talking about this and doing research to support this. The ICU family research has focused on their experiences, and I've only identified a few of the references here, and of course I'm not going to read them out. It's just to show you that there's a lot of research that's been done about their experiences and the stress that they feel and their coping patterns. There's also been research on their perceived needs and satisfaction, and this has been the biggest area of research with critical care families using a tool that Molter and Leske developed back in the late 70s called the Critical Care Family Needs Inventory, the CCFNI. Now, this is a qualitative survey tool, of course, and has become the golden standard in research about critical care family members' needs and the satisfaction with those needs, and is used all over the states, particularly to identify if family members are getting what they need when they go to a critical care unit with a loved one. There have been a few research studies done about interventions to meet the needs, some of those interventions based on what the critical care family needs inventory has identified as needs that family members have that need to be met for them to have a satisfying experience. Nursing support as a concept has received minimal research attention. It has been imprecisely and contradictorily used, and I want to identify here Gardner and Gardner-Wheeler, who say that nursing support needs to be looked at differently from social support, and much of the literature lumps it with social support as being almost the same thing. However, other research on social support, if you look at how those authors define social support, nursing support has no room to fit into there. So it just depends on your definition of social support. Nursing support is enmeshed with concepts of care, comfort, supportive care, social support, and professional support. All concepts that have been researched, and there's been no clear-cut guidelines provided to show the interrelationship among those. Nursing support has not been studied in terms of family identifying the process engaged in by nurses. So the purpose of my study was to delineate the process of nursing support from the perspective of family members of critically ill adults. The research question, how do family members of the critically ill adult describe and explain nursing support for themselves and their family unit, is what guided the choice of approach as well as design for this research. The definition of the family was whoever the patient or the family member identified, so it was a very broad definition, was not constrained in any way by genetics or a relationship, legal relationship. So the phenomenon explored was nursing support, and it was not used as a term in the interview unless participants used it to explain what nurses did that helped them. And interestingly enough, they all did. So I quickly got into using it in my interviewing as well and was able to focus on nursing support because that's what they called what nurses who were helping them did. They supported them. Family identified what they perceived was supportive to them. So I said that my question drove the approach and design that I used, and it was the grounded theory approach, a qualitative approach, and I used Strauss and Corbin's version of that grounded theory. There are two schools of grounded theory out there, and I chose to use theirs. As a beginning researcher, their approach helps give you more guideline as you're moving forward in your analysis. And then you move on from there and can look at it differently from just the way that Strauss and Corbin look at grounded theory. Grounded theory was the approach I used that helped me with my recruitment and data choices, data collection procedures, and my analytic techniques. Family members were recruited using posters placed in 7 ICU waiting rooms of 2 tertiary care centers in Alberta and by word of mouth. 20 family members participated for a total of 27 interviews. And these interviews were conducted where each family member wanted, and I conducted them either individually or with a family group if that was the choice. My initial interview questions were, what has the ICU experience been like? What has helped you with this experience? What has not been helpful? Did you feel helped by nurses? How and how not? If participants used the term support, then I asked, can you tell me what you mean by support? And what has been supportive and unsupportive for you as an individual and family in this experience? I audio taped the interviews and field notes and transcribed them. That was quite a job, as any of you who've done qualitative research know. I think I have over 18 inches of transcription. You measure it according to the number of inches. I identified concepts that were subjected to constant comparison, and this is one of the techniques that is used in grounded theory. It's used also in ethnography and some of the other qualitative approaches, but it's absolutely key to grounded theory analysis. These concepts were coded and recoded, and over time, interview questions changed as they were informed by the emerging theory. So they became more specific about what I was finding and what was coming out in my analysis. Memory and diagrams were very, very important for informing my analysis. I guess I'm a visual person and I have stacks and reams of diagrams that I've done both online on my computer as well as freehand that really helped me distill all these different concepts and come up with the theory that I eventually did. And Nudist was used to manage data and to track categories. In terms of my findings, a theory of nursing support emerged, and the core category, light neon load, was revealed. This theory is comprised of the context of nursing support and the process of nursing support. For those of you who are not familiar with grounded theory, you are always looking at a process when you conduct grounded theory research. Now, there are people who use grounded theory techniques and do not necessarily get as far as analyzing to the point of finding a theory or a process, but that is the ultimate end of conducting a grounded theory study. And the study is never just about the process because the process is always in context. In terms of the context of nursing support, it includes the critical care environment, the critical care patients, critical care family members, and the family members' work of getting through. The process of nursing support includes engaging us, sustaining us, and disengaging us from us. The context of nursing support is what I'll speak to first. The critical care environment, I think most of you are familiar with what a critical care environment is like, either from TV, if not from personal experience. So as I mentioned previously, the setting was two Western Canadian tertiary care centers. There were two general systems ICUs, which means the person could have any type of systems difficulty, and they would be put into this kind of an ICU, as opposed to a burn ICU, where you go if you are specifically burned, one neuro ICU. There was constant activity in these units, and technology was dominant. There was short length of stay for the most part, but that was not the case for all of the family members of the participants in my study. ICU access in both all ICUs in both hospitals was closed by permission only. And there's been reams of research to suggest that this is not the way to go. However, it still is what has been practiced in these hospitals. The waiting rooms were adjacent to the ICUs. In terms of staff and staffing, RNs were full-time, part-time, and casual. They might work at one hospital one day in an ICU and go to another hospital another day and work in a different ICU. They worked 12-hour shifts, and they had 1 to 3 patients per shift depending on the acuity of the patient's condition. The RN's education, experience, and personalities vary from just your basic RN to a Bachelor of Science in Nursing to some master's prepared RNs. Enthusiasm for and comfort with family access varied.
I'm sorry, it looks like we have lost audio, so maybe if you could back up
yes.
to the last slide.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Do this whole slide again?
I think it was just...
the very end.
Did you just go back one slide?
I did.
Okay, I think this should be okay.
And just repeat
this slide, yeah.
Okay, so just a bit of an overview of the critical care environment. As mentioned, the two Western Canadian tertiary care centers, two general ICUs, one burn ICU, and one neuro ICU. Constant activity, technology dominant. Short length of stay, ICU access closed, permission only. Waiting rooms were adjacent. Staff and staffing, the RNs were full-time, part-time, or casual, working 12-hour shifts, 1 to 3 patients per shift, and many worked more than one hospital. RN's education, experience, and personalities, of course, vary, and this is based on the reports from the participants. Enthusiasm for comfort with and comfort with family access was varied, and again, this was from the participants' perspective. Physicians were best accessible if meetings were scheduled, and competent patient care was the expected norm. Nurses exerted minimal control over the waiting room or patient assignment, and family members saw that this was not the purview of nurses, that they just had to deal with this. I happen to know as an insider that that's not the case, that nurses do have a lot of control over that, but family members did not see that. So they felt that the unit supervisor influenced by example, and if the unit supervisor was positive about family, staff on that shift were more positive about family. The physician staffing patterns negatively influenced the continuity of care the patient received, and I heard this loud and clear from all participants. However, this was not the focus of my study, so I only presented as a comment about staff and staffing. The best nurses, and best was defined by them as they valued family, they felt the best nurses should be assigned to ICU. Again, technical competence was expected as basic, but it was not considered enough. A number of participants discussed the nature of critical care nursing and how that must affect the nurse who was always there. Anything in yellow is a quote from my participant. I don't think you could last in the job if you got too personal. You have too many deaths that occur and stuff. So I can't imagine if you let yourself get totally, personally involved with every situation up there. Because you build relationships. And I think it would be really, really hard. I don't think you can't build some sort of relationship as a human being. You do. But I think they try to keep their distance a little bit. And I'm okay with that. The awesome and the great nurses will sort of set the stage for how that shift is going to work itself, because their personality and their leadership qualities will come out and reflect on the other nurses, as well as the younger nurses that don't have the experience. I don't know if nurses know or understand what family members go through. I think if they understood that, they might take a little different viewpoint on all this. And how do you teach that? Work with the great nurses, with the really high-class veteran nurse. That's where the learning comes from. And I think, too, if there are problem nurses on the floor with bad attitudes and ignorance, those nurses need to be reported and they need to be moved to a different part of the hospital, because the ICU is a very tough emotional place to work. If you drop off the bad ones and bring in the good ones, she can get stronger and stronger, and they'll work together as a group and they'll support each other. In terms of the context of the nursing support, the critically ill patients were a factor. There were 14 adults aged from 24 to 76 years. Their length of stay was from 24 hours to 270 days. I had mentioned that generally they were short-term patients, the relatives of my participants, but not all of them. They had very diagnosis that just goes across the whole spectrum of what could have been found wrong. Patient status, 9 were in ICU, 5 were transferred, 2 were discharged when the relative was first interviewed. So that showed that I got a good feel for different moments in the trajectory of the patient's illness. I got this kind of information from family members. 3 patients died between the first and second family interview. And those family interviews were particularly rich in terms of what their needs were around the grief and dying process. In terms of the context of nursing support and family members, there were 7 male and 13 female family member participants. They were aged in year from 26 to 73, and the first interview was conducted between 3 to 172 days post-admission. So again, a huge range there, and previous research had generally focused on the first 24 to 72 hours. And this was quantitative research, not qualitative, that had been done previously. And obviously the picture it's a bigger picture when the illness has gone on for such a long time. There was a range of relationships to patients, husband, wife, sister, brother, son, daughter, and daughter-in-law. And occupations from professional, trade, homemaker, an individual who was on AISH. So I had quite a range without even trying to get that range. The home locale, I had rural, urban, and out of province. And 12 had previous ICU experience, 7 had no previous ICU experience, and there was a range of marital and parent status among my participants. The patient at the hospital now became the family member's focus. Other responsibilities were secondary, and these individuals' lives were in turmoil. But families, when someone is in ICU, the balance is lost automatically because you have something going on that just isn't normal, that you don't want. You feel so out of control as it is, and there is no control over what's going on. Your normal life isn't normal anymore. Nonetheless, participants demonstrated conspicuous resolve and resilience in order to get through, with each family member bringing unique characteristics to the experience, including family structural and social network strengths. The following exemplar is illustrative of what contributed to their getting through. You have to have some inner strength and a belief in yourself, and that's definitely been proven to me, because I get people saying to me, I don't know how you survive. I don't know how you've managed to do all these things. I don't know how you've managed to go through all this. You manage because you have to. There's no other choice. And that was from a participant who was going on 6 months with daily visits, living at the hospital all day from out of province. Oh, it's much more intense than just being in the hospital and visiting for a day and that person is home again. It takes up so much energy, so much energy to deal with that. And like I say, you deal with the fact that you might lose your relatives. You deal with the fact that all of this other stuff's going on. So therefore, the family members expended energy visibly when they became involved in care, or invisibly while waiting and worrying, feeling angry, frustrated, and fearful. All of these actions, internal, external, took energy. Participants also expended energy in actively breaking down whatever barriers prevented them from getting what they needed. The wall between the waiting room and ICU came to represent all the barriers that participants had to breach to gain access to their ill relatives, to nurses, and to physicians. It became a barrier to access to information, to allay fears about the patients and their care, and a barrier to trust in the professionals. Then when we got to that set of doors, the doors were open, and I was walking through. A nurse says, "Where are you going? You can't go. Stop." I said, "I'm going in." "No, you can't." And it was like, holy cow, talk about feeling powerless. That just about killed me. It was all I could do. It was like, who can I tell? I'm so upset here. I'm dying. You have no idea what that does to someone when they're stopped right there and the nurse says, "No, you can't go past this point." Using energy to breach this wall served only to add to their workload. What did this work consist of? I needed to understand this to interpret how nurses were or could be supportive. And this was not something I expected to find. This whole workload piece of the critical care family members was a new piece of information that has previously been unreported in the literature and that does set my study apart because it's more than just needs. It's work that they're doing. And work, when you look at it as work, it assumes a different level of respect as opposed to them just being needy people. They're going through a crisis. What can I do to help you with your crisis? They saw themselves as having to work, and they wanted not to have their work interfered with. So the context of nursing support that loomed huge in my analysis was the family work of getting through. And I really struggled with this, not analyzing the family work, but moving from work to what it was that they were telling me about the nurses. And this is something different about my grounded theory to any that I've been able to find, is most grounded theory is about a social phenomenon happening to you that you influence. This is a social phenomenon that is kind of imposed on them from somewhere else, but their perceptions of that. So it's just a new, it put a different twist, and I really struggled because as a new researcher, I was trying to find somebody else who'd done something like this, and I couldn't find it. Anyway, the most important thing was gaining access. They had to get into the bedside because they had to be there. They needed to be vigilant and monitoring. They had to be advocating, providing information to the nurses about the family member, decision-making, providing patient care, gaining respect, avoiding confrontation. Their own self-care was part of their work, as was partnering with the staff in the care of the patient. This is the hardest job I've ever done in my life. It's like going to a job that you just hate. You can't stand it. But you're so far in debt, you have no choice. You still have to do it. So when you have that type of responsibility, or that commitment, you've got to be there for the person you love most in the world, because otherwise she's going to be gone. That perception that if you weren't there, they might give up was huge among my participants and perhaps helps nurses understand how why families are so desperate to be at the bedside when someone is that critically ill. It was just awful. You would go there, push the buzzer, no answer. So you're behind this wall, no visible person to talk to. Before I left, I was going to punch the damn thing out. I really was. That's how angry I was at that wall. It's like the Great Wall of China. And once you're past those doors, you're part of what's happening. Interestingly, none of my participants had any contact with each other, and five of them spoke of it as the Great Wall of China. This is about gaining access, the most critical piece. Nothing can happen if they cannot get access. Access to patient and access to information were interconnected. Waiting time was dictated by the individual nurse. and these nurses had complete authority over family visiting. Some nurses never asked family members to leave. However, others kept the family waiting for long periods of time. The longer the patients stay, the easier the access to the patient, to nurses, and to information. You become familiar. They get to know you. It makes sense. Again, under being there, by being there I sort of learned and understood the routine of what happens in here. When you first come in off the street and you walk in here, you have no concept of what's going on, so it becomes a learning experience for you. So there was really nothing that I could do other than be there and find out exactly what they were doing and why. I always asked the question. I had to. Then we wanted to be there with the patient for resuscitation attempts, procedures, and physicians rounds. These were generally occurrences that resulted in the family being asked to leave. But if they were not allowed to stay, and most were not allowed to stay, they lost out on learning about what was going on, about talking. They lost out on opportunities to talk to the doctor. And in terms of resuscitation attempts, and there's a big movement on now that family be allowed into the resuscitation rooms in the ER, it's easier for family members to accept death because they see that everyone is doing their all for this person, and it's often easier for them to make the decision not to do any more heroic measures because they see what those heroic measures involve, and the TV does not do it justice at all. It definitely eases the grief period as well as the anticipatory grief. And there is research to support this, and yet our hospitals still do not encourage or allow family members present during resuscitation. They knew that staying helped them to learn and understand, and they worked trying to influence the nurses to help them stay. That was huge, the political work that they did with nurses. Just how much to push, how much to withdraw. They were constantly had their antenna out on how to react to each new nurse that they came across to get what they had to so they could get their work done that they needed to get done. They could have said, when we're doing an exam, have one person in the room. Please stand back against the wall because here's a man who may not make it and I needed to be with him. Being with the person if they die was critical. In terms of providing information, they saw themselves as very important in personalizing that patient to the staff so that they realize that this is not just the person who cannot speak to you, who cannot respond to you in any way, but that he was a very well-educated man who had accomplished all kinds of things. And this was one of the quotes that I chose for that. He's a very, very well-educated man, which makes it all the worse because he knew what was going on, but he was unable to respond other than to blink his eyes. So she's gotten to know our life and to know about him through me telling the stories about it. And once you personalize the patient to the nurses, it makes it harder for them to stay aloof. In terms of gaining respect and avoiding confrontation, this was most stressful over the length of stay because this happened with every single new nurse that came on. You don't want to be overbearing with them because you may piss them off, or they avoid you, or they don't want to talk to you, or they leave you out in the waiting room. So you end up getting no information. So you find yourself in a balancing act where you're trying to get all the information, decide what's going on without offending anybody. In terms of the work of monitoring and advocating, I just feel I have to be there to protect her, whatever I can do. And this was from an individual who had been in the ICU for many months and had learned a lot, noticed many errors, and as a result felt chained to the ICU because he knew what needed to be done and he was determined that no one would make any more errors because he would be there to protect her. That was huge, the protecting of the loved one. He cannot talk for himself. He can't even ring the buzzer when he's in distress, so therefore I have to be there to do that. In terms of decision making, they were very much involved in that, as you can understand. I had the idea in the back of my mind that this end of life was a decision that I was going to have to make. I went in to see the doctor to tell him that the family had decided and that I was in support of turning off the machinery. Those are very, very difficult decisions that family members are often in a position to make. And it was part of their work. Providing patient care was a very satisfying activity for family members. But many of them were not involved in providing patient care because they didn't know they could be involved. They weren't invited to be involved, and the technology scared them when they first went into the room. Over time, they learned they could be involved, and if they wanted to, they asked for it, and there was varying degrees of involvement that different nurses allowed. You said I could brush your hair when I brought in the brush, and yesterday I noticed your skin was getting quite chapped, and I noticed that her cuticles were all really in, and so I asked the nurse, and it happened to be one of the casuals. He was really impressed with me, so I asked if it was okay if I put some lotion on her, and he said, oh yes, it would stimulate the circulation and that sort of thing. It felt so good to be doing something like that for her. And this individual was crying when he told me this. So the power of just being able to put lotion on. In terms of self-care, that was the least important to them. Family members work involved activities to sustain themselves by conserving energy. I don't have the energy right now to be there every day, and I'm smart enough to know it, because I know I have to take care of myself and my kids. It's self-preservation. You have to do what you have to do, and this is how I have to do it. I still go every other day. And this individual was suffering from guilt imposed by other family members for not going more frequently, and she made this decision. And there was an awful lot involved in it, of course, beyond just this. But there was a whole spectrum there of individuals saying they couldn't look after themselves. All that mattered was the patient, to people over time coming to this point. They were burning out, obviously, and you can see that happening. And partnering was the most rewarding, so ultimately participants viewed themselves as indispensable to the patient care team in their involvement and necessities. I became his case manager because the staff and doctors changed so often. The continuity was a problem. And this woman was extremely proud of the fact that she took on this role and knew that it was a very important one. Some participants expressed regret about not having tried harder to be more involved and experienced anger and guilt as a result. This, in turn, appeared to influence the time and effort required for them to move on following the patient's discharge or death. I still think about it. I'm still angry over it. I think I'll always be angry over it. And this was 2 months after the death of the family member. I get so mad at myself because I would say, I should have said this, I should have said that. So what has work got to do with nursing support? Well, family members' work required energy to meet perceived responsibilities to get through the experience. I interpret that to being akin to carrying a heavy load, and it didn't come easily. It's interesting, you do these presentations and you put these words forward, and you have no idea the grief you go to before you come up with this carrying a heavy load, but it took a long time. Nursing support is therefore about not adding to that load, and ideally about lightening the load for family members. Ergo, that's how I came up with my core concept. The process of nursing support, lightening our load, occurs within the context of the patient, family member, family unit, nurse, critical care, and health system environment. And it mitigates the impact of the critical care experience for the family member. We can never make it good. All we can do is make it less bad. In terms of the process of nursing support, lightening our load, there were three phases that emerged. Engaging with us, sustaining us, and disengaging from us. And I will discuss each one individually. First, the nurse begins to develop a connection with the family by engaging with us. To do this, the nurse lets us into the unit as soon as possible by acknowledging the individual as family, who is important to the patient and who needs above all else to be at the bedside. And then by making us feel welcome while family are at the bedside. Then the nurse begins to get acquainted with the family by orienting us and relating to us. Names are shared, relationships and information about who can visit are clarified, expectations, roles, and responsibilities are discussed, and orientation information is provided as the situation and the patient's acuity allow. If the nurse and family member have met before, they become reacquainted. As they become acquainted or reacquainted, respecting us begins or is extended if family members perceive that nurses are trusting us by looking upon family members as competent in their own right and by seeking family members' input about the patient and then by empathizing with us, feeling our suffering and therefore keeping waiting times to a minimum, providing frequent updates about the patient in consideration of the family member's needs. In terms of phase one, engaging with us, I mentioned how important welcoming us is. And this is a category that I struggled with. But it really did fit the bill when you think of how someone comes to your door, knocks on the door, and you welcome them in, and the tone of voice that you show, and the way you behave around them. I felt that that really wasn't going too far to say that when family members felt welcomed, they were very much supported. They didn't have to fight to be allowed in. Next, the nurse becomes involved in sustaining us by building on either the nascent or reestablished relationship with the family. I guess I should mention here why I'm saying reestablished, and I said that with the last two slides. And that's because as a process, this is recursive, and it goes on and on with every time you go back to the hospital, a different nurse or the same nurse is who you engage with, and you go through these steps, albeit perhaps very, very quickly, but nonetheless, the steps do occur. The nurse is reassuring us by first being there, present at the bedside, then by communicating with us through listening, sharing information, helping family members understand, and by chatting with family members. And by being accountable to us in terms of providing competent, consistent, and responsive care. This being accountable was extremely important, and this is where when a nurse would make a mistake, they would own up to it to the family member, as opposed to not being accountable and hiding it, and the family member would notice something later. Family members are offered opportunities for involving us in patient care by sharing responsibilities with us, negotiating with us, and valuing us. In advocating for us by promoting self-care, the nurse ensures that basic amenities for food, rest, and comfort are available. And by connecting us to other professionals and services, organizing meetings and case conferences with physicians, as indicated. One of the things that came out a great deal was that family members were not provided with an orientation, that the waiting rooms were quite inhospitable. They had to go down to cafeteria to eat or get coffee, as opposed to having coffee machines or food machines in the waiting rooms like they do in emergency. And they didn't want to leave because they might catch the doctor or something might happen, so they wouldn't eat or have a break because it wasn't amenable to that. One of them said if you had coffee there, it would be a place where maybe we would connect with other family members and there would be some of that support group activity going on. But when everybody had to go somewhere else to get any refreshment, the waiting rooms ended up being places where you just sat until someone would let you in. And there wasn't a lot of communicating going on. The other thing that was a problem was when there was grief, there was nowhere for family members to go and privately grieve. Some of the units had rooms that if you, depending on your nurse, they would take you there to do private grieving, but family members spoke of the public grieving that they had to witness that only made it harder for them. The chapels were at a great distance from, in both hospitals, from the ICU. In terms of phase three, disengaging from us, the nurse responds to the range of situations signifying departing. such as when leaving for break or at the end of shift. This also includes the nurse responding to family members departing at the end of visit, as well as to the family departing when the patient is transferred from the unit or when the patient dies. For each of these departures, the nurse reacts to the changing nature of the situation and facilitates us moving on by guiding our decisions, helping us find meaning. In evening departure, the nurse prepares us for the transition and bears witness to the intimacy inherent in the experience by saying goodbye with a look, a handshake, a hug, or tears. Saying goodbye may include the nurse attending the funeral, visiting the family on another unit, sending a card on an anniversary day, or just acknowledging the patient when they see them in the hospital at another point in time. I'm not sure how well this is showing up when you piece some of these kinds of documents. I apologize. Anyway, in terms of the entire process of nursing support, each of these phases occurs over minutes, hours, or days, based in large measure on the family members and nurses being present at the bedside, and reoccurs with every family member and nurse encounter. It can happen over the telephone, at a distance, if you don't live in the same city. That is still gaining access by getting through to the bedside nurse on the phone, who can tell you about your relative's condition. Whether or not the family member and nurse have met before, how each encounter unfolded, length of admission, influences the speed, depth, and breadth that each phase is experienced. The individual nurse, patient, and family member's circumstances, as well as those of the family unit, the specific culture of each ICU and hospital milieu, also influences how the process of nursing support is enacted over time, including such specifics as the nurse's workload, schedule, and comfort dealing with family members. This context represents a dynamic force collectively shaping and reshaping the expression of the process of nursing support. Lightening the load alleviates some of the family's workload, and in so doing, bolsters the family's innate resources to get through the critical experience of their loved one. In terms of summary of findings, in the face of crisis, family members demonstrated endurance and resolve. They worked to get through, and this has previously been unreported. According to family members, nurses can support them in their work by lightening our load through engaging with us, sustaining us, and disengaging from us. Phases occur over minutes, hours, or days, and reoccur with every family member and nurse encounter. So when the nurse goes off for coffee and a different nurse is looking after the patient, even how that nurse responds to the family with a smile, as opposed to turning her back, his back. Supporting family members feel valued and respected is important to their relative's health team. Comparing concepts. This was an additional aspect to my analysis that went beyond just grounded theory. This was more based on the literature as well as on my findings. I compared lightening our load with general and specific conceptualizations of caring, comfort, supportive care, social support, and professional support. And those of you who are not nurses maybe don't know that this dialogue has been going on for quite some time. You nurses have is caring their purview, and they have the ownership of caring. And there are some of us who think it is too general, too broad a term to be used for what it is that nurses do. Anyway, I did a lot of study in this area since I did my master's, and this research helped inform how all of these are connected. Many shared characteristics are there, of course, but the comparisons expose the relationships among these concepts. So connecting more dots, these are conceptual dots that have nothing to do with the actual, well, they have something to do with the theory, but they are not a component of the theory. Social support results from humans caring for each other. And caring is not the purview of just nurses. Caring occurs by humans, period. Based on various levels of social connection, Professional support, however, refers to those aspects of social support provided by professionals in response to specific needs that cannot be met by social intimates. Nursing support is a specific form of caring and the specific form of professional support provided by nurses to family members in response to the critical illness of a relative. Nurses care for family by being supportive, and supportive care is equivalent to nursing support. Comfort is a significant outcome of the provision of nursing support. One of the underlying presuppositions that supports this notion of nursing support is sort of depicted by the fact that, well, I have the bridge there as a background for a purpose, but basically what nursing support champions is the valuing of the individual strengths and abilities to do whatever they have to do. And we're just there to be a little bit of wind beneath their wings. They're going to get through this in spite of. And what nursing support is it values that and just says, here, can I interject here? Can I interject there? It is different from this caring, let me do it for you. In terms of unique study findings, I've mentioned a couple. The theory emerged from the perspective of family members across the time span of their relative's critical illness, as opposed to just within that first 72 hours that is the case for most of the research. Identification of critical care family member worth is mentioned. That's never been identified before. In fact, I was going to defend, and I had already written up my discussion and said, nobody's talked about this work, and I happened to bump into one of my committee members who said, well, have you read Strauss and Corbin's work on work in chronic illness? And I said, I've never heard of it. So I did a lit search. It didn't exist. They wrote a book back in the 70s about family work in chronic illness. But it didn't show up in a lit search because, you know, books don't always show up in lit searches. So I quickly read that and had to rewrite my discussion chapter to include that because somebody else has discussed work of family, but in relation to chronic illness, not in relation to critical illness. But it's interesting, nobody's written anything about it since then. Extends knowledge of family needs beyond the critical care family needs inventory. It demonstrates that there's a number of important needs that family members have that are not encompassed within that survey tool. The importance of gaining the trust and respect of nurses so as to be taken seriously by nurses and physicians has never been reported anywhere. Lots on how you need to trust the physicians and the nurses, but not about them trusting the family members and what family do to gain that trust. There's nothing been written about accountability, and I'm not, you know, of course when I go looking these terms, I'm not just looking up under accountability. It was a much broader search than that. It's just what is encompassed under being accountable to us was not researched or was not presented elsewhere. Welcoming us was not discussed in any of the nursing research. Disengaging from us and guiding our decisions as necessary or supportive to family members throughout the course of their relative critical care admission was also not covered by any of the literature that I reviewed. Saying goodbye has previously been reported, but only in terms of bereavement. And it really made a difference to my participants if the nurse said goodbye at the end of the shift. Just goodbye. That was it. It's just those normal social behaviors that we do when we are welcoming to people. It provides evidence for describing relationships among the related concepts. Limitation? When a sample was self-selected, therefore, there's opportunity for participant bias, definitely. All of them said to me that they wanted to get involved because they wanted to improve the situation in ICU for subsequent family members. I wasn't expecting that. I expected some people to respond because they'd had a great experience. So what I did was a lot of negative case analysis to come up with what was the positive situation. but was able to go back to my participants and tease that out further because they hadn't all had bad experiences all the time. There had been positive experiences as well. This particular point, the last point, there was no coronary care unit or cardiovascular ICU family members who volunteered, although I put posters up in all of those waiting rooms and mats, or waiting rooms. This is significant and requires, and is interesting in terms of additional research. My thinking and my experience is, even from going to the different units to present my study, that the nurses in coronary care, there's lots of money poured in there. And most nurses are a lot more savvy about the latest research than the nurses in the general systems ICU. This is just the visit research. This is just my anecdotal experience. When I went to present my study to get their approval, none of them had heard of Molter in any of those other ICUs. The CCU and CVICU knew everybody. So maybe they were already practicing it. Maybe these were the people who could have told me about the positive situations. Also, there was open visitation. Certainly in one of the units, one of the waiting rooms was shared with CCU and General Systems ICU. And the General Systems family members would watch the CCU people just go in and out at will. So right away, that gating access that was huge in my research wasn't a problem. What would that have done to my results if that had not been a problem? Now, why did I not go out and recruit CCU and CVICU? Ethics. I was not able to personally approach anyone. They were considered vulnerable, and I had to just see if people would respond to my poster. Interestingly enough, a physician who was conducting research at the time at one of the hospitals was using a room where I wanted to meet with family members. And I just asked him if he was finished. He said, yes. And who are you? And I told him. And I told him about my research. And he said, how are you getting your sample? And I said, well, I've got a poster here. And he said, oh, well, that's going to be a biased sample. And I said, yes, but I couldn't get it past ethics. He said, why? I am doing an intervention with drugs. And I'm asking the family members to agree to let me do the intervention. And I'm the person doing it. So talk about vulnerability and who, mine was far less intrusive than what he was doing, but that was seen differently than what I was doing. So in terms of implications, families' perspectives about the process of nursing support has been heard. There's increased opportunity for ICU nurses to understand family needs. There's potential for increasing ICU nurses' sensitivity to family work and nursing support. The study further validates open ICU visiting rules and the provision of adequate amenities. That's sort of an oxymoron, open ICU visiting rules. Although it should just be open visiting. It validates the importance of ICU nurses developing respectful relationships with family members. It can inform instrument development for measuring nursing support for comparison to outcomes. Because I'd love to know, what is the cost efficiencies here in nurses being supportive? How do you measure it so that you can determine whether indeed it has benefits economically to a unit or to a health system? The theory clarifies the relationship of nursing support to related concepts. Questions for future research? At what point in the illness trajectory do families identify their work as a burden? That is significant because we talk about caregiver burden for people looking after the elderly in their home and people looking after individuals with schizophrenia or what have you, and it's spoken of as a burden. It wasn't spoken of as a burden from my participants' perspective. Whose label is the burden? And if the label does come from the family members, is it after they've come to the point where they're burnt out with what their activities are with respect to the individual? What are the benefits to the nurse when nursing support is provided? What are the individual nurse barriers to providing nursing support to families? One of the reasons I undertook this particular study and this particular design is I wanted to deconstruct what nursing support was because I believe it can be taught. I really do believe that individuals who don't naturally respond this way can be taught to be more responsive if we can break it down into steps for them. How can nurses be supported to support families? What does the collaborative professional support process look like? I've done some work in this already, theoretically, where there's a collaborative support model where all of us work together. It's no one person that supports what's going on with this family member or with this patient. What is the connection between therapeutic relationship and nursing support? And does nursing support prevent family member depression or post-traumatic stress disorder? Conclusion. In this presentation of my research, I've discussed background information, the study purpose research question, qualitative design, which was grounded theory, and research methods and techniques. I discussed my findings, the theory, which is comprised of both the context and the process. I've discussed study limitations, implication for nursing knowledge and practice, and future research questions. Being supported is knowing that there's a lot of turmoil. There's a lot of stuff going on besides the person that's in the bed. And the nurse is having the smarts to know that you're not only dealing with a sick person, you're dealing with his family and everything else that goes with it. Taking a genuine interest in you as a family, that's the kind of support we need. I wanted to pause for a moment and have you look at the bridge in a fog. Because I see it, and of course it's a support bridge in a fog. I love metaphors and I love diagrams and everything. And you could look at the murky waters underneath as being the critical care illness and the family needing to go from one side to the other and being supported, one pillar perhaps being nurses, another pillar being physicians, another pillar being social work, whatever. But I did like this picture when I saw it. Oh, excuse me. For some reason I just had to click one more time. It's my connecting the dots going on here. Critical illness of the patient, that's the foundation of what happened. You have a family member. I have a very strong arrow, heavy arrow here because there's a lot of connection between the family member. The critical care nurse, she has a strong connection with the patient as well, but not as strong as with the family member. And ideally, there will be connection between the critical care nurse and family. It remains to be explored what the value to nurses is in lightening our loads, but I have hypothesized that there are significant ramifications when it goes that way as well. Thank you for your interest and attention. I don't know if there's any questions.
Well, we've already got one question in Illuminate Land, and okay. There's some hand clapping. I'm going to let Helen take the mic and ask your question. Go ahead, Helen. I'm just recalling the text message. Helen doesn't have a mic, so she can't ask the question. But Bev does have a question, and since we're struggling with Illuminate Land, maybe I'll let Bev, we know Bev's mic works. And Joan, if you have a question as well, by the way, for those that are on Illuminate Land, if you do have a question, there's an icon of an outstretched palm on the left-hand side of the screen. And if you click on that, a number will appear beside your name, and we'll take questions in that order. But go ahead, Bev. And when you're done, simply click on the mic to release it.
Hi, Virginia. Thank you very much for this. It was very interesting, and I really enjoyed your presentation. I have actually two questions. One is whether I'm a little puzzled by by your understanding of nursing support as combining caring and professional support, and then trying to link that with something that was in one of your last slides about collaborative professional support. So my question is, I know, do you think that there is a spectrum of types of professional support that's disciplinary based? So for example, social worker support may be different than nursing support, and how would you see that playing out in an environment like critical care? And then my other question was, as an educator, what would be two main lessons that you would want me to take away from this as an educator of nursing students?
Okay. Oh, sorry. I'll answer your first question. That's the easy one. yes, I see professional support, and this is supported by, you know, an extensive and exhaustive lit review, as well as from the results of my research, as being different depending on the discipline. And I did a little bit of work into what it might look like if you were a physician. And I had also done work on this when I first came to Athabasca, because I thought, well, gee, what is tutor support? What does that look like? Is that different? And yes, indeed, it is different, because we have that evaluative piece that is, we evaluate students, which is a totally different component that isn't there necessarily in what I'm speaking of as nursing support. So collaborative professional support is where different professionals provide support, however that looks, depending on their discipline, and together you end up with family members feeling supported by everyone. I certainly got a lot of data from my participants about not feeling supported by physicians. I got some about feeling very supportive, and I could look at my data and come up with what support from a doctor looks like, because I got the data. I'm not sure, I hope that answered your question as well. The chapter that I wrote that's in the textbook Transforming Health Promotion Practice, it goes into collaborative support a little more, because I have written on that before. In terms of what I'd like you to take away from this for your, as a teacher, I guess it's the grounded theory piece. I think that grounded theory has been much used, not always well used, and there's differences between grounded theory techniques, of course, and grounded theory full blown, which is what I did. So hopefully just some better appreciation of what a grounded theory looks like. It should always be about a process, if it is indeed a true grounded theory. So in terms of the research methodology, that's one piece. The other piece I'd like you to take away is a consideration of nursing support as being a concept that perhaps crosses units and types of nursing, that nursing support is more about a way of being. I can't say that based on my research. I only was looking at ICU family members and nurses. But I think that it's something that deserves further exploration, and certainly I've done a lot of work with Jan Morse's comfort work, and she and I have had quite a few discussions about where this whole idea of nursing support fits in to the care models that we provide our students. And I think the beauty of the idea that nursing support is based on valuing the strengths of the individual can really influence how we teach our students that kind of respect and looking at the strengths and not coming from the traditional paternalistic way of looking at our role with family. Did that answer you, Beth?
Sorry, yeah, yes, Virginia, thanks a lot for that. That was very helpful.
We also have a question from Helen Ewing, who is without a mic, but has asked, first of all, she said it's a very good presentation, as I must agree. Has it been presented to ICU staff? And if so, what has been the feedback?
Actually, Helen, it has. I presented at the Critical Care Canadian Association of Critical Care Nurses last September, and it was very well received. And interestingly, the U of A asked me to come and present it to their critical care nurses, ICU nurses, and I ended up having to do two presentations because there were so many people. Now, interestingly, there was one person who said, there's no way I'm nursing like that. There's no way I'm having enough of that design. But that was okay. She ended up being in a room with other people who were so positive about this. And one thing that I think is interesting that I would, how do I put it? My participants, and I read those exemplars about how do you teach nurses to be this way? Well, put them with the great nurses. Put them with those veteran nurses. Well, what I found in my presentations, it was the young nurses who were very open to this way of being with family members, that it was, they were the ones that asked me to come and speak. They were the ones that stayed after and wanted copies of my work. And the one individual certainly was a more senior nurse, and this is the way she'd done it all her life, and who knows how many didn't even come, perhaps, because they felt that way. But I was very nervous about that presentation, to say the least, because I had to be very careful. I didn't want to offend them as well, because they are, you know, that was something my participants kept saying, is that, you know, they would always give the nurse the benefit of the doubt. Always. They loved the nurses, even when the nurses weren't being and doing as much as they wanted, because they saw that nurse as the key to the health of their loved one. They didn't see the doctor as the key. They saw the nurses as the key. It's a powerful position that we are placed in by the family members. And so I hope that answers your question.
Helen doesn't have a mic, but if she is satisfied, if she may show me a happy face. And Joan also has a question. Joan, she's smiling. Joan is Cuban from, is also have a question. I'm going to let her test her mic. She's written it out, but maybe she wants to have us hear her voice. I'm just going to read her question. Maybe there is a problem. Nope, she doesn't hear. She doesn't hear. Anyways, her question, I hope she's hearing this. My question is related to the cultural differences in your sample participants in both nurses and families. And I guess the question is, you know, were there differences as a result of culture? And maybe I'll add gender too.
Yes, actually there were 7 participants who were male, 14 who were female. There was Aboriginal representation. There was people from Europe, representation from individuals who moved here from Europe. I wouldn't say it was broadly cultural, but that was a component in terms of the participants who responded to the poster. Had I been able to do theoretical sampling, which is what one should be doing with grounded theory, and I was able to do a little bit of that, but were I able to do more of that, I would have gone out to get more diversity to see if I had been able to find out even more than I was able to find out from the sample I got.
Joan's smiling. So.
Okay.
Now, for those in the room, if you do have a question, yes, just press the mic and hopefully and illuminate Len. If you don't hear the question, please give me a sign somehow.
Hi, Alvin Finkel. Virginia, I found your presentation really interesting. One of the things that came to mind when you were talking about the work that family members were doing is that part of that work seems to be figuring out who they can actually get some satisfaction from, because as you mentioned, in some cases, you know, some nurses were allowed at the bedside, some wouldn't, some, you know, would give them more details and others wouldn't. What wonder about is, what kind of rules are these nurses working under? Why is there that much discretion and power, really, on the part of nurses to exclude? Do the hospitals not have an overall philosophy in terms of this? What underlies a lot of this behavior that allows so much individual discretion?
Well, Alvin, being a historian, historical, basically, it goes back to how ICUs were set up and from the medical model that they were set up and the scientific model where we are going to save this life and you poor person are out on the other side. Mm-hmm. And the theory that people coming from the outside would bring germs in and would be overwhelmed, the paternalistic way of looking at family where they can't handle seeing a patient looking like this. We better not let them in. There was all of these aspects that influence this. ICUs were developed after the 40s, and they always started off, all of them, as closed units. And it's been in the last 20 years that there's been people battling at the doors, and if you get informed nurses, you see change in that. It is basically the nursing staff who have the power to influence those kinds of changes. Power is huge. When one of my committee members, who happens to be our vice president, said to me, "This is about Foucault and power. You need to write another paper that talks about the whole power piece." She's right. Of course, it's about power, and it's about sharing power. What does partnership mean? But the sharing of whatever it is that you're focusing on. So. A lot of it, too, is in how we reward the nurses, how we recruit nurses to ICU. You can't be fearful of technology. And there is a thinking out there, I mean, if you take a look at your cancer hospitals, where you have these absolutely incredible personal connecting kinds of individuals frequently that you come up against in a place, say, like the Cross, but it's not really high tech there. There's thinking that high tech people perhaps aren't as open to this other side. And when you are evaluated as a nurse working in an ICU ICU unit, no one ever says, "Gee, you're great with family. I'm going to give you an A for that." Like, it doesn't even come into it. Mm-hmm. How quickly you do your cardiac outputs, do you have your patients all organized? It's the military model as well. Mm-hmm. Efficiency. There's just so many factors. And so when we reward, when we hire people, not necessarily for all the right reasons. Mm-hmm. I remember when there was downsizing happening, I was working at one of the ICUs, and someone who had worked at SANC bumped into ICU. Well, you should have heard the ICU nurses complaining about this person. However, this person was an excellent nurse. She learned the technical skills, which anyone can learn, mm-hmm. and she ended up being so wonderful with family members. To give you a little taste of what it's like to work in an ICU. And of course, I haven't worked in one for a while. I've been to them recently, but I have not worked in one. But when I was working, it was not infrequent that you would hear people say at shift report when patients are assigned, "Oh God, I got one that can talk." Because many patients are ventilated. And when they're ventilated, you have control. You do your caring and bed arranging and wires and everything. Now and some of these were pretty neat nurses, but that comment was there. So there's a whole hierarchy in the hospital. If you're an ICU nurse or an emerge nurse, you're a step above. You walk around with your stethoscope. Like there's just so many things. And maybe it's part of, as well, what they talk about. I'm thinking of emancipatory, but that's not the right word. You know, women as being the feminist back thinking there, but women being oppressed. So these nurses don't have a lot of control, and when they work in ICU, you've got so much control that you control those under you. So there's a lot of things that come in there, and I just touched on a few.
So it's not a hospital
policy then? No, not hospital. It's unit. And the unit makes the decision based on the individuals on that unit. Sometimes the physician won't like the idea of open visitation, but nurses have been known to change physicians' minds because a lot of physicians don't want the family there when they're doing their rounds. But the nurses have tremendous influence on those decisions. And nurses, if they get changed, it's usually the nurses who do the changing.
you'd mentioned, sorry, just to follow up, the cardiac or the units that are open, and obviously units can be open. So what are the features of, is it just money, or I can imagine that heart stuff is pretty well
sexy. Heart conditions are sexy. And you know what? Heart patients may have a very sick heart, but they're not always necessarily very sick people. I mean, yes, they can have another heart attack within the first 24 hours and pass away. So they're at risk for something, some crisis to occur. But the crisis is generally over by the time they've been resuscitated or treated and they're in the coronary care or CVIC unit. So it is a different population. The people who are in your general systems or your burns or multi-system failure being kept alive and kidney dialysis and, the amount of machinery is incredible.
Another difference you notice is that men in the ICU after heart surgery, they often think they look like a Playboy centerfold. That's because they have staples going up their middle.
Thank you, Jarman. I have one other point that I'm going to
talk about. I'm asking a question.
Oh, sorry. I thought you were getting pornographic here.
Okay. You can debate whether Playboy centerfolds are pornographic, but that's probably another question. When Luciana was in hospital last year, one of the problems was the nurses all wear this psychedelic outfit. And it's impossible to tell the difference between a senior nurse, a junior nurse, and a cleaner. So you're asking virtually the toilet washers what drugs they're on or whatever. You can't tell one from the other. Did that come up?
That came up from some of the data I got from participants once the family member had been moved to the ward. Yes, I got a lot of information about that. There was a lot of problems once, and that's where preparing them for going to the wards was a big deal because it was such a shock to go from what really was nurturing care for the patient of the ICU unit to, free-for-all once you got out on the floor. Absolutely. One of the points I just wanted to make in terms of what I'd like educators to take away from this as well, I thought of that while I was talking, is that the sharing of the power. I think that, whatever we can do in our education of nurses to discuss that whole piece of the sharing of the power, I think is extremely important. And the idea of not always going with the flow, with just because everybody else won't let family members in, be an individual. You can do it. Yes, Anne.
Anne Goldblatt. Virginia, I was thinking in the years that I've worked with nurses in community health, that often what I felt is there are underlying values and assumptions about the people with whom they're working in the communities, their role in relation to those individuals and families. And at times I've thought to try and challenge some of those values and assumptions when you see people's notion is of a higher, that they really are better than, and they're coming to save people from themselves. Do you try and, or do you just say, because you made a comment earlier about this is a step, you felt optimistic that you can teach people to shift their practice. But at times I've thought about, do you try and challenge those underlying assumptions, or do you just say, you're not going to get very far on that because that's some of the core that people bring into their practice. So now you've got to look at it or enter at a different point, which is more, these are some of the concrete ways in which we express a different way of relating to people in our practice that's more respectful or that leads to better outcomes or some different way of framing it so it's not about trying to get at those underlying assumptions that they have about people, because it comes through so strongly. If people are talking about sharing power, those people who are comfortable with it are happy to talk about power sharing, and those people who never thought that that was part of what they came in to do, they shut you down very quickly, and they don't hear it in the same way.
Yeah, I think you've raised a very good point. When I went to speak in Newfoundland, I prefaced my remarks by saying I'm preaching to the converted, because the people who chose to go to buy session were doing so because there was interest there and they were open to something like that. Now, my love and where I want to teach this is undergrad to new nurses. You may be able to show by example to more, and if new nurses can influence the culture of a unit and drag nurses who've got a different way of looking at it along the way, fine. It may just be attrition as well. But the whole socialization piece that happens on these units, and in nursing, just in nursing, forget just ICU, but that socialization piece is huge. And new nurses want to belong and want to fit in, and sometimes will give up some of their values or, you know, not bring them to the forefront because they want to be part of the team. So it's new. That's why I still teach an undergraduate rather than graduate, because to me that's the level where I can have an influence in teaching these sorts of things to individuals. I don't see that I have a lot of influence at the other end.
Follow up? This is timely. I just had a conversation with a colleague that has a friend in the hospital, but she expressed the same kinds of concerns in that she felt she had to be there because they were going to not mess up, but and I don't want to, you know, say that there's incompetence, but she, you know, that they were, it's almost like, you know, with a sort of compartmentalized approach to healthcare, there's more opportunities for miscommunications to happen, and so, you know, simple mistakes in her mind were being made just because care was being passed off to one person to another. You know, this is maybe not be the right metaphor, but we're doing some house renovations, and the issue is you have to have a general contractor on site all the time, or else, you know, people will take shortcuts, and if you really want quality care, somebody's got to be there. You know, is this a case for a new role, or, you know, a new professional, you know, somebody who can be the liaison between the family and the professionals and can, you know, be tuned into both sets of issues and also do that learning, that the learning curve that for families, you know, is so steep because you're going into this environment and new rules, you've got to figure them out, and as you say, you've got to figure it out without pissing off anybody because you don't want to be shut out. So I've asked a few things, but I guess the question is there, do we have to sort of fix this from within, like is it something systemic about healthcare that needs to change? Do we need a new role for this, you know, well-established connection? I mean, you know, the health of the family and the patient is mediated by these social relationships, which are not addressed at all in the sort of healthcare system.
Yes, the short answer is absolutely yes. I don't think we need a new professional. I believe the nurse is the professional with the insider knowledge and the ability to work with the family if that nurse has had the education. Usually I'm looking at a clinical nurse specialist. That's one way that the role can be enacted as a case manager or clinical nurse specialist liaison nurse. I actually, in my master's degree, had to write that job description for myself and argue to get that job at the Foothills Hospital. However, that's when Ralph cut. And a liaison nurse for families would seem to be not important at all. But that's what I did for 2 years. I was the liaison nurse. When someone was brought into emergency, I was called. I dealt with the family, brought them into the resuscitation room, and followed them through the hospital experience. Now, people would call that perhaps Cadillac care. However, until we do the research to show the benefits economically, as well as the benefits otherwise, we will have a lot of trouble enacting that. I really would like to see more and more nurses seeing working with family as part of their role, but it's hard for them to be part of their role when they're overworked. And we all have heard about how bad that is. I purposely did not ask nurses what they thought. You know, I wasn't going there. That's been another study. So I talked about that family member being the case manager. Case management nursing has been around for a long time, but we have not jumped on the bandwagon with it. for lots of reasons, and I don't know if I have time to go into them. But that is something that works extremely well. Another component of my master's program, I went to the University of Michigan because they are known for their family nursing in ICU. They have at least 17 ICUs. And I worked alongside of other nurses and experienced this family nursing from their perspective. And what they do is their nurses are more managers at the bedside than our nurses are, because they hire unregulated health professionals to do the technical stuff. I came back and talked to colleagues about that. And of course, there is no way that you're going to hire someone off the street to do cardiac outputs or measure my urine or do ECMOs or whatever. So they have a different way of looking at it, and there's a lot I don't like about the health system down there, but that works. And it worked beautifully because she managed three patients. Other people did all the primping, but she was also there to be with the patient and connect with the patient, but she could also meet with the family because she didn't have to measure the urine every hour and do the hourly cardiac outputs and all those technical things that don't take the knowledge that nurse has. She needs to be used more for the social interaction sorts of things. But too much we value those technical things because they used to be physicians' technical things, and they didn't want to do them anymore, so they gave them to us. Because there's nothing much to be gained from them. They're just a technique. And
It seems like there's a real dilemma here because you mentioned at the beginning of your guest, or I'll recommend to your guest, I should say, that nurses have to protect themselves too against emotional involvement because that's very difficult for them to handle. I mean, when they're working with people or dying on a regular basis, they have to develop a certain distance in order to survive themselves. But at the same time, you're saying that they do their job best when they're caring more, and that involves a personal outlay, right? An emotional involvement. You really you can't be caring in a professional way, you know, like develop a certain caring veneer or whatever. I mean, it seems to me. So this is a real dilemma. I mean, how do you survive yourself and also give yourself to your patients in this kind of way that enables their healing, and especially to the families, as you say, too. That's an even further extension of it.
Well, this is so exciting. I want to get on a sandbox because I really remember at the very end where I showed those arrows and how I felt that if the nurse was supportive to family members, probably there would be something going back to the nurses. I know from experience that that happens. I do not know from research that that happens, however. So I can't claim it other than anecdotally. The comment you came in on was a family member mentioning that they were apologizing for the nurse not connecting because it must be hard. It was a family member making that comment. It wasn't that I was saying that nurses need to keep their distance. I feel that the more you get involved with family, and I'll have to say up to a point because you're not going to become best friends, and everybody who works in a helping profession judges how far they can go, you get back. And I have an experience again from my master's where I was following a particular family, and this family just kind of blew me away because they had moved here from Africa. They were of East Indian origin. And so they were immigrants, right? But they had thousands of friends. And here I was. I had moved to Calgary in my own province, my own country, and I knew nobody. And I found this really an interesting dichotomy. Anyway, I would go up there to meet with this lady who was the spokesperson for the patient and the spokesperson for the family, and she's who the family wanted me to be with. And they saw me as her support. She was the support for all of them, but I was the support for her. And to support me in supporting her, every time I went in, they brought me food. So, you know, what goes around comes around. I really believe it. It's not like I was Korean. I just love Korean. But that, the family member, I followed four family members in my master's. And the other one was an Eastern European family who were very closed system, if you know what I mean. They just don't open up to, but I happened to be there at the time of admission at a motor vehicle accident. And I was there with the wife and was able to, she opened up to me because she was devastated, of course. She closed right up afterward, and a colleague of mine who was following patients in ICU got to the family at a different stage, and they wouldn't open up for her at all. For me, they came to my graduation, they gave me a gift to go out to dinner, things you're not supposed to accept. So I'm saying it comes back to you. And if nurses wouldn't withhold, they would get it back from somewhere else. And family is where you can get it back big time, especially when you've got critical care patients who can't necessarily communicate. You know, they're ventilated, papillonized, what have you. I've had tremendous giving back to me from my family members, more than I get from my own family. So that's my answer in a nutshell. I just think we've got to try. And so I have to go out and do research to somehow quantify it so that we can see if indeed there is value and benefit to the nurses from this.
Well, Virginia, I want to thank you for what's been really a very interesting presentation. I think you've illuminated a number of issues that I just hadn't thought of, for critical care units. So thank you once again. And I also want to thank those in Illuminate Land for staying on. I have to, they're clapping their hands as well.
Oh, thank you.
I have to disengage from Illuminate Land. So, but if you want to say one thing real quickly.
Yes, one other thing I thought, teach families to question. Don't just take everything at face value. You can question. There are ways to get around systems, and that can be something that we can be teaching as well.
Thanks. And thanks to the Research Center for providing some food and space and room. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
That's my call. Yeah.